I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Summer camp season is in full gear now, and legions of American kids have left or are preparing to leave home for camp. And if he could, our guest today would cheer every car headed out, stuffed with sleeping bags, duffel bags, and pillows, as he heartily praises the summer camp experience. We're talking this hour with renowned child psychologist Michael Thompson, author of many books on parenting. His latest is called Homesick and Happy: How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow. But it might as well be called the Summer Camp Solution, because in it, Thompson argues that with today's plugged-in, ever-busy kids, camp provides a whole different space for children where they ditch the electronics, the hyper-schedule, the parental demands, and discover new skills, make new friends, and overcome new challenges posed by the great outdoors. Today in The Exchange, Michael Thompson joins us making the case for summer camp, and let's hear from you. Did camp play a major role in your life? If you have kids, do they go to a sleepaway camp? Why or why not? And is there a downside to summer camp? Is it not for everyone? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Michael Thompson, welcome back to The Exchange. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's really nice to be back with you.
Well, this book is about camp, but you write that it's also about a fundamental question that all parents struggle with, a fundamental question that you as a family and child therapist have looked at for decades. So what is that, Michael? It's a lot more than just camp is good or not.
Look, this is the most dedicated, loving, conscientious generation of parents we've ever had. They're also wildly anxious, and they also think that their presence always adds value. And I'm arguing that when you are there, your child doesn't necessarily experience the same kind of psychological ownership that they do when they're on their own. I have been asking audiences for a long time now, tell me the sweetest moment of your childhood. And then I say, well, for how many of you were your parents present for that sweetest moment? 20% of people raise their hands. And they say, you know, Christmas, Easter, family vacation, Seder, whatever. And it's just the kind of thing that parents hope children will remember from a family event. But 80% of them say their sweetest memory comes when they're away from their parents. And it usually means away from your parents, with your friends, doing some things that are challenging, even risky, and that might make your parents a little nervous. And those kinds of experiences are so vivid and so helpful in forming identity. And where does that happen these days? In the suburbs, where we're driving children everywhere and we have them in so many organized activities. One of the places you can go to get away from your parents for an extended period of time is camp.
So those sweet memories of childhood, Michael, you know, taking a little risk, being out with your friends, doing something your parents might not approve of. It isn't just about fun, though, or that was cool, or that was a neat memory. You say it's a crucial part of child development.
Exactly. So one middle-aged woman said to me that the sweetest moment of her childhood was when she was 11, and she had her two little cousins with her, and I can't remember if they were 8 or 7. But they were out in a field of high grass, and they kept walking, and then she realized they couldn't see any landmarks. The grass around them was so high. And she realized she had to get her cousins back. She had to find the way back, and she was scared, but she led them back, and she was so proud of herself because she did something, and she was in charge, and she was the leader. And those are the kinds of experiences I hear over and over. I was there by myself, and I had to be a grown-up, and wasn't that a triumph, you know?
So you repeatedly say in the book, you know, in so many words, and you've just said now, great things happen for kids when parents butt out. But that's not the message we parents get, Michael. We're always being told, do more, be present, be involved, right. Join the PTO, right. You know, on and on and on. So what do you mean?
And I probably give 150 parenting talks a year. And I came to understand that people are always saying, what more should we be doing? How should we be doing it better? And I was saying, in certain situations, you ought to be doing less. How do I give my child self-confidence? And I would say, you can't give your child self-confidence. Self-confidence is something a child earns by mastering developmentally appropriate skills. And the way to give your child self-confidence is to put them in a situation where they're going to face some real challenges and overcome it. And if that isn't the definition of camp, I don't know what is. So the subtitle of my book is How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow. And that really tells you what the book is about. I originally promised that I'd do school trips and semesters abroad and many different away-from-home experiences. But in the end, I wrote about camp because it is typically, for an American child, the first sustained experience away from home.
What are the trends that you heard about, Michael, about how parents, these parents you described today, very concerned, very involved, very caring, anxious, how are those parents feeling today about sending their kids to summer camp, and how has that changed from, 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, summer camps now, especially the high-end camps, have to put up photos every day on their website so that parents can see their child at camp.
How's it doing?
I know that the camps are hiring a photographer who takes pictures all day and spends all night culling through them to make sure they have no pictures of a child frowning, because parents freak out if they see their child frowning, as if none of us ever had a bad picture taken of ourselves. But I had a guy out in Teton Valley, Wyoming, who runs a camp, and he's so far out in the wilderness, he's connected by his wife. His internet is connected by satellite, and it doesn't always work reliably. And if he has parents waiting in New York for the photos to come on, and if they're a minute late, people start calling in a panic, because parents are not trusting the camp, or they think they have to microscopically follow everything their child is doing. And this comes from going to all of your children's town soccer games. You know, you think you have to see every moment of their performance, and you feel guilty if you don't. And I don't, I'm taken to telling parents, watching your children's soccer games is very entertaining for you, but it doesn't necessarily add value for your child. And a mother in my hometown of Arlington, Massachusetts, when I told her that, she got quite huffy. We're the kind of family that always goes to our children's soccer games. I said, yes, I know, but I went to lots of my daughters, but I don't think you always add value.
You know, in terms of the trends, too, Michael, you wrote in the book, I think that the trend is not only for this sort of more vigilance and checking the website and maybe even calling and trying to email and so forth, but also parents don't seem to be sending their kids, if they do send them at all, they're not sending them away as long as they used to. You know, I've talked to adults, 40, 50 and up, who went away for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. Today it's more, a week or two. So what's going on there?
So it's there's an issue of cost, of course.
Sure.
Sending a child to 4 weeks of camp or 6 weeks of camp can be very expensive, especially at a high-end camp. There are more inexpensive camps, but usually the longer ones involve more money. So we have to acknowledge the economics of it. But what I find is that parents are willing to send their child to three different one-week camps that are sort of skill camps rather than to 2 weeks away or 3 weeks away or 4 weeks away. And that's puzzling to me, because what they want to do is let the child go off and then come back and tell the parent all about it, and then send them off again and pull them back after a week and tell the parent all about it. They want – it's a way of being involved with the parent and sort of – overseeing skill development. And I think if you're going to send a child to 3 1-week skill camps, I say send him to one J general camp for 4 weeks and let him have the experience of becoming part of a community, making friends you don't know, and building relationships.
Mike, let's bring our listeners into this. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Child psychologist and author Michael Thompson is with us, making the case for sending kids away to summer camp. Let's go to Annie first. She's waiting in Saxton's River, Vermont. Hi, Annie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. This is a serendipitous show. My son, who is going to be a senior in high school, just got back from 2 weeks at the Governor's Institute of the Arts program in Castleton. And for older kids, I think it's a different experience, but I'm hearing everything that he experienced, and it was amazing. And I think for older kids, it's not only a chance to explore all those wonderful benefits that you've been talking about, but it's also a chance for them to try on adulthood for size and get a bit of a rehearsal in the college experience. You know, they develop a sense of independence and developing friendship, and they really get a sense of, you know, being responsible for their own schedules. And in this case, it was a wonderful creative program. So they had workshops and lessons and lectures and performances. And he came back a changed man, a changed young man. I'm just profoundly impressed.
What was the biggest change you saw in him?
Oh, he seems to be much more just confident and settled in who he is, and confident about, you know, his talents and his possibly his professional pursuits in the future, because we're looking at colleges and some of them are art colleges. And his teachers were just amazing. They were awesome and taught him so much about his skills that he already brought to the table that he didn't really know he had. So I think his whole outlook on the future has really shifted, and his ability to excel.
Well,
and
Annie, we'll talk.
Nothing I could have offered him, you know.
It's good to hear from you, and I definitely want to follow up with Michael after a break on something that you said. Going to a skills camp, Michael, versus a sort of general traditional campfire camp, if I could call it. So we'll talk about that. I'm glad your son had a good experience, Annie, and we'll be back after a short break.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The exchange is coming to the North Country. Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts will be taking your questions as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. The exchange on the road is happening at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem this Thursday. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Partly sunny today, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some thunderstorms may have gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs today in the 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Novus Engineering, celebrating 25 years of providing diversified engineering and consulting services to clients throughout the Northeast. Information at novusengineering.com. And New Hampshire Magazine, featuring 280 winners of Best of New Hampshire 2014, plus the Building on Hope project at the Opportunity Network in Amherst, New Hampshire Magazine. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, child psychologist and author Michael Thompson on his new book, Homesick and Happy, where he strongly urges parents, if they can, to send their kids away to summer camp. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Did summer camp play a big role in your life growing up? If you have kids, do you send them away to sleepaway camp or not? And is it possible that sleepaway camp, that traditional summer camp that Michael Thompson talks about, isn't for everyone? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Michael, I did want to follow up on Annie's call, and I'm glad her son had such a great experience. She sent him to an arts program camp, and,
right.
And you read in the book, and this is not putting you down, Annie, because it sounds like it was great for your son, but you write, you're really more of a fan of the traditional, general, sleepaway summer camp, you know, marshmallows and ghost stories and hiking. You're not a fan of specialty soccer camps and so forth. How come?
Well, let's talk about it. And he said he was close to the end of high school. And what he did was really college preparation. And But he had an away experience, and because he went away and made relationships with teachers in an area which was of tremendous interest to him, he was essentially practicing being away in an arts college. And having had a son who went to an arts camp, I'm all for it. I think my son's experience in an arts camp was life-changing for him, because he suddenly met a whole lot of artists who do this full-time, and it gave him a look into adulthood. When I talk about general camps, I'm talking about kids 8 to 12 or 8
to
13.
Uh-huh.
When you start in high school to have away experiences, you're not likely to go back year after year in high school. Many kids have to work, and so I'm talking about a younger child than what Annie's son did. But I will say this about camps. When people ask me what's the best preparation for college, and they're thinking SAT tutors or summer school, I say without any question, the best preparation for college is going away to summer camp. Because you learn to manage yourself, organize yourself, and live in community. And that's really an important set of skills for succeeding in college.
Well, you certainly do live in community in those big dining halls and in those cabins where there's, you know, 8 or 10 other girls or boys. What about organizing yourself, though, and managing yourself, Michael? There has been a critique that, you know, some summer camps are just more of the same hyper-scheduling that kids get all year long. You know, at 10 o'clock we'll have swimming, at 11 o'clock we'll have boating, at 12 o'clock we'll have lunch, and on and on and on. What do you think?
Right, but most summer camps almost without exception, give kids choice. So it's not like school. It's not, you know, you have this prescribed day. Kids get to choose, and they get to play to their strengths, sometimes avoid their weaknesses, except for swimming. You have to learn how to swim in camp,
yeah.
And that's terrifying.
So I've heard.
Passing that test can be just a major developmental achievement for some very frightened children.
So they do have to break out of what they normally do, and they do get a lot of downtime, as you put it. You know, they advertise on the website, look at the water skiing, look at the horseback riding, but you're saying there's actually a large amount of padding of downtime in that day.
Yes, and many camps have a rest period after lunch, and one of the really interesting things is walking around a camp and watching kids lying on their bunks in a tent, all reading. Or playing card games, because camps don't allow electronics. And while some are starting to, because they're afraid they won't get campers unless they have some electronics an hour a day, I'm fighting this. I think that for American children, the only time in their childhood when they will have 2 weeks or a month without it being besieged by electronics is when they're at summer camp.
Let's go back to our listeners, Michael. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And going to Peter in Durham. Hi, Peter. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Thompson. Thanks for being on the show. And I actually went with my 7-year-old son to a camp for a few days, just as like a dip your toe in the water thing.
Yeah.
One of the things that I realized, or that struck me, the thing that struck me most when I got there, which was I felt was different from when I had been there as a kid, was the presence of like the strong presence of medication. Like medication was part of the day. So when you got there, if your child had medication to take, they would check that in, and then there are all kinds of protocols for dealing with it. And then various times during the day, the whole camp would be informed that, you know, if medication was needed, now is the time for you to go. And I realize that medication has always been part of life. You know, people need to take their medications. But I'm wondering, it just seems like such a large piece of the activity that I'm wondering if that's an indication of other things going on, and if you see camp, how you see that, the medication of kids in camp interacting?
That's a really interesting question, Peter. Thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Peter, yes. I was at a camp and was watching the after dinner. It seemed like a quarter of the camp was lining up at the nurse's office. And I said to the camp director, so this is more than it used to be. He said, way more. I said, are they all these kids on real prescribed medication? He said, many are, and a lot of them, their parents are insisting they line up to take vitamins or supplements because the parents want to have a hand in giving their child something healthy every day or having the nurse give it. So I had a fifth grade teacher out in Chicago who'd been running a school trip for close to 20 years. And he said 20 years ago, people just sent their fifth graders on this two overnight a trip to the school. But now every parent has to sort of arrive at his classroom and have a few minutes to have a little seance and discuss their child's vulnerabilities and give him the vitamins and the inhaler. And some of the kids are on meaningful medication, but a lot of them, the parents just are supplementing. And the fifth grade teacher, I won't name him, said, I just leave it all in my car and the kids never ask for it. Look, we are giving children more medications. There are more kids on stimulant medication for ADHD. We're getting 7 to 10% of kids. Whether they should all be on in the summer when they're in a camp setting, that's a matter of debate. We sometimes have children on anti-anxiety agents. And of course, there are children who may have non-mental health-related conditions for which they need medication. But there's no question, more American kids are on medication than ever before.
So let's go back to the parents. And I remember that story from the book about the fifth grade teacher who 20 years ago used to just take the kids on the overnight trip and go. And now it's this big deal. You write, Michael, about homesickness. In fact, that's part of the title of the book. But you also write at the end of the book about child sickness. And camp directors will tell you they face a rising challenge of child sickness. Now, what is that?
More child sickness than homesickness.
Really?
Camp directors tell me. Yeah, I mean, homesickness is real. Children, children universally experience some sense of yearning and loss and sadness when they're away from home. What it means is that they have parents who love them and a home that they care about, and they have a pet or a pillow or a favorite meal, and they're missing it. About 81% of kids have mild homesickness that they can get over in, you know, 3 or 4 days, or it doesn't last all that long. They may cry one night when they're going to bed, or some kids cry when they wake up in the morning and they realize they're at camp, not at home. About 19% of kids have significant distress, really a sustained bouts of crying. And what we don't give kids credit for is knowing that this is something they want to beat or have to beat. When I read Chris Thurber's research, the biggest homesickness researcher in the world is actually a psychologist from New Hampshire named Chris Thurber, and he's up at YMCA Camp Belknap right now, as he has been every summer for more than 30 years, and in the winter he's the psychologist for Phillips Exeter Academy. But he studied homesickness, and he looked at kids who had very bad cases, and about a third of his 19%, that is about 6 out of 100 kids, have unrelenting homesickness.
6 out of 100, not very much.
Well, I have camp directors who say, that can't be, because they don't want parents to be scared by that. But when I read Chris Thurber's research, I went to my 20-year-old son, Will, and said, Will, you were pretty homesick at camp. And I know you were in the 19% with significant distress, but did you have unrelenting homesickness? It was ever with you all the time, every day, for the month you went. Yes. Yes, Dad. Really? It didn't pick up a lift at any time? Yeah, in the last 2 or 3 days, Dad. I said, well, why'd you go back a second year? He said, because you wanted me to.
Dad. Oh, dear.
And then I felt terrible, of course. I said, you could have fought me, and your mom would have sided with you. No, you know that. She's not a camp person. And I said, why'd you go back, Will? And he said to me in all seriousness, Dad, if you can't learn to sleep away from home, it means you have to live with your parents for the rest of your life. And his tone suggested that that was a kind of a nightmare scenario. What kids know is that they need to conquer their homesickness and be away from home. But parents who think they always should be there to protect their kids, to buffer their children, to keep them from disappointment or humiliation or failure. When the child is away from them, the parent, who's kind of all in their parenting, then feels helpless, useless, and they get a very bad case of child sickness.
Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Judy's in Freedom. Hi, Judy. You're on the exchange with Michael Thompson. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. We just dropped off we have 8-year-old twin boys. And we dropped them off at summer camp on Saturday for their second summer.
For their second summer? Wow. So they've been going since they were 7. Wow. It's a big deal.
Yeah. It's a 2-week swing away camp.
So are you feeling child sick?
Well, it's funny because what prompted my call was last summer when we dropped off the boys, that first letter that I got home for my son, Wilson, it was horrible. It was all phonetically spelled. He said, "Mom, come get me. I miss you. I cry every night." And I just remember getting that letter and wanting to run up there and grab him. But I didn't, and I'm just so glad that I didn't, because the next letter, you know, he had a picture of him on a hike and some nice drawings and saying that he had fun. And they both wanted to go back again this summer. So, but I was...
That first letter can be tough, though, Judy.
That first letter was so tough.
"You abandoned me, Mom. I'm out here suffering.
Come and get me." But I was talking, I was out for dinner with my husband, which is another one of the perks of summer camp.
a relationship, an actual marital relationship.
Yeah, and I was talking about Paul Tough's book on the keys to success, and he talks about grit. And I really think that that's another huge gift of letting our children be in situations where they need to overcome it themselves.
You can't rescue them.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Exactly. So I'm just very glad that we sent them again and they both wanted to go. And I'll wait and see what the first letter home is.
Judy, thanks a lot for calling and we really appreciate it.
Judy makes a very important point about grit. Grit is a list of 7 skills that Martin Seligman and his co-workers talked about, non-cognitive traits that guarantee success in life or are seen in children who become successful in life. You know, it's not all good grades that make you successful. It's grit and self-control and humility and gratitude and social intelligence. And we can also talk about 21st century skills, problem solving, collaboration. These kinds of things camp teaches very well.
Let me jump in, Michael.
I think in the present debate, everybody thinks everything has to be taught in school.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because we've done so many programs on, you know, college and getting in and how competitive it is. And, you know, I'm just picturing myself as a college admissions director and looking at one kid who sort of, you know, I don't know, did double academics over the summer or worked really hard at a job or something. And you know, another kid who, you know, maybe had a campfire marshmallow camp experience, you know, that great traditional camp experience that you love so much. I don't know if admissions directors at colleges are looking at those non-cognitive traits that you say summer camp so well develops.
They absolutely are. I've talked to college admissions people. Oh, yeah. And they know if they have somebody who's been away at a camp for 3 years running, it's somebody who can make a commitment to a community, as I say, who can live in community, live in a dorm. If you've lived in a bunk with 10 kids, you jolly well can share a room with a roommate.
Right.
And many people get to college and they're simply not ready to live with a roommate, live in community. And the kids who drop out freshman year, I better not camp kids. Camp kids stay.
Let's go back to our listeners. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Brenda's calling from Sunapee. Hi, Brenda. You're on the exchange.
Hi. I just wanted to tell about my camp experience in the 50s. I went to Girl Scout camp in Missouri for 2 weeks. It was $25 a week.
That's pretty cheap, Brenda.
Pretty cheap. And I did it in the fourth and fifth grade, but I had sort of a crazy mother, and so she brought me and my friend there, and she brought bathroom spray for the outhouse, and bug spray for the tent, and I'm saying, don't kill the daddy long legs, they eat the mosquitoes, you know, and then when they were leaving, she was hysterical, and I'm going, it's okay, Mom, we'll have fun, you know, she was unbelievable. And then I had a friend who had a really strict mom, and she was homesick every single night. She cried herself to sleep, but it was, we had to eat everything. Do you ever hear of no thank you helping?
Yep.
You've heard of that? That was three Girl Scout bites. Whether you liked it or not, they made
three Girl Scout bites.
Girl Scout bites.
That's great, Brenda. Well, and you write about this in the book, Michael, about how, you know, for some kids, it's a break from the parenting style of their parents. As much as you might love them, you know, Brenda's mom was a little intense.
Their mother sent me the correspondence. She had a son who had ate an extremely limited diet at home. And he wouldn't eat this, and he wouldn't eat that, and he wouldn't eat that. And she sent him off to camp, and he wrote her his first letter is, Mom, I'm eating this, and Mom, I'm eating that. And when he came home, his whole his palate had broadened enormously. Might not have been her choice of foods. Camp food is sometimes fairly basic. But her son was eating three times more things than he had been when he left, because she was catering to his likes and dislikes the way all parents do with their children in one realm or another. And camp couldn't cater to it. So he just had to get with the program and eat.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Brenda. And in just a moment, we'll talk more. Michael, I've got an email from someone that I want to share with you who, again, is concerned about the mixed messages that parents are getting these days. So we'll talk about that after a break. Also, someone who says he doesn't send his kids to camp, not because of parenting style, but more the affordability. So we can cover that as well. More conversation, more thoughts and questions from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. More with Michael Thompson in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, what Congress can accomplish before the midterms, then the latest on the Aid in Dying movement, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Partly sunny today. There's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some of them could have some gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs today in the 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric. Tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork, online at justcallheritage.com. And from the Salmon Press Media Group, a family of community newspapers, websites, and magazines covering towns from the Lakes region to the Canadian border, salmonpress.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, a roundup of Supreme Court news and decisions. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, best-selling author and child psychologist Michael Thompson on his new book, Homesick and Happy, where he makes a strong case for sleepaway summer camp. You can join us with your thoughts, comments, questions, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's an email that came in from Jen on the Seacoast, Michael. And she says, my question is, what about the mixed messages that parents are getting due to the very real issues of abuse, bullying, children having sexual experiences earlier than previous generations? All the things that parents are being told is the reason to protect, protect, protect. And Michael, we've all seen headlines about, you know, the one camp counselor who ends up being an abuser. What do you think? Thanks a lot for the comment, Jen. I appreciate it.
I don't have any evidence that there's more child abuse in camps than there is in life. It's a real problem, and it occurs in families, and it occurs in communities, and undoubtedly there has been abuse in camps. I know something that it's something camp directors worry about enormously, and they do their Corey checks, and they are trying to find people whom they know to be trustworthy. It's something the camp directors think about. What I want to know is, are you absolutely sure you can keep your children safe every moment? You can't, and you have to sometimes trust an institution, and I think camps are pretty trustworthy institutions to look after children. These are people who are really dedicated to looking after kids and keeping them safe.
Well, and I think the stats have shown that most child abuse, especially sexual abuse, happens within extended families and friends of families. So it's
right.
That's true. That's out there as well. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And to Londonderry, Chris is on the air. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am an educator. I'm a middle school educator. And one of the things that I've noticed as a person who is trained to work, with middle school students is parents often question the decisions that we make based on what we think is best for their child compared to what they think is best for their child. And I'm not, I know this is not a camp setting, but oftentimes my colleagues and I talk about this idea that we've got the background, we've got the training. If you will just trust us in the decisions that we're making every day with your child's education, that we really do have their best interest in mind. And I'm assuming that this really extends to the camp setting, in that these camp counselors, these people know what they're doing. The parents have selected this camp. So what happens to that trust factor? These kids go away to camp, and suddenly it seems as if this is breakdown, and the parents believe that only they know what's best for their kid. Hurry up and send them home at the first sign of homesickness. Hurry up and send them home the very first time they're served something that they don't like, and that we don't know how to deal with their child. Like, in other words, their child's anxieties or issues are so unique that only the parents are qualified to make the decisions for their kid.
And you're saying, Chris, someone else might have a better idea, a professional.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
I'm seeing very much the same thing, and this is what I mean about it being such a loving, conscientious, dedicated, but wildly anxious group of parents. And generation of parents believes that being attuned to your child is really the most important, emotionally attuned is the most important thing. But it may be that when your child is anxious, you are so attuned that you get even more anxious. And the person who isn't wired into your child's anxiety can get a different performance out of her or him. That's why sometimes a 19-year-old can teach your child to swim when you couldn't. Because you were feeling your child's nervousness so much, you couldn't push him or her. But a counselor can.
Yeah, you talk about that. Yeah, go ahead.
It's not a very trusting age. And I'm running into middle school parents who say, well, my child can't go on this overnight school trip unless I go with him. I have to be the chaperone. And it's usually the parent's anxiety, not the child's. And the parent has no sense that she, and it's usually the mom, is changing the nature of the experience for the child. Because when your mom is on the school trip with you, you don't get the feeling of psychological ownership and independence. You do if you're away from her.
And, the independence that we've talked a lot about, Michael, folds into this idea of the counselors, though. I mean, the kids aren't completely just randomly running around. They are guided by, each cabin has at least one, often two counselors, usually people in their, 19, 20, 21, 22. How do they play a role in this development? Stepping back and letting the kid fail, letting the kid have the experience, but keeping an eye on things.
I find camps a place where they're doing more leadership training than any school I've ever visited, because camp directors are looking at 11 and 12-year-olds and think, could she be a good counselor?
Really?
When
that
she
early?
Grows up? Oh, yeah. And then they go through some counselor and training program when they're 15 or 16, and then finally they make it to being a counselor after they're 18. And a lot of these kids have been really in a kind of management training program since they were quite young, being given tasks and leadership tasks. When your group's out canoeing, do you help cook? Do you make the fire? Do you set up the tent? Do you teach new kids how to set up a tent? And the camp directors are all watching these kids and evaluating whether they could be good counselors, and they get their pick of the litter.
Let's take another call. This is Rochelle joining us from Hill. Hi, Rochelle. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi there. I worked at a camp for 2 years during the summer. My husband was there for 8 years, and there's no way I would ever send any of my children to camp. We were in our 40s, and we were observing people in their 20s and taking care of children. There were lots of accidents, a lot of irresponsibility. One child actually passed out jumping from one of these kind of like trip lines because the counselor was encouraging this young girl to experiment. Zip lines being put in without proper safety. Children getting poison ivy.
That was something that was the counselor's responsibility that she passed out?
Basically, the child was encouraged to jump from a tower. They had made it constructed. The project was to construct a tower. And I guess this counselor was actually about 25 years old. He had some commando experience or something, was trying to toughen the kids up and had a tower, and the child jumped off with this like bungee cord thing. And there was just a whole lot of nonsense like that, including when the septic tank was pumped, a whole bunch of condoms being in the septic tank when they had a teenage section of the camp. It's young people are the age of the counselor. Sometimes they need to be supervised very carefully.
A little too wild for you, Rochelle. Now, is it possible that it was just this particular camp, that not all camp is like that?
Well, this was a very well-known camp. I'm not going to obviously name names. This was a well-known camp, a well-supervised camp from a religious organization. And I just feel that when you have children taking care of children, you have some problems. That's just how I feel. I think that's something that gets covered up, that doesn't get noticed.
Rochelle, thank you for joining us. This is an important point, and you do have a great affection, Michael, for the counselors in your book. You talk a lot about them. But, you know, let's face it, 20, 21, 22-year-olds don't always make the best choices. How do you address Rochelle's concern? She says she would never send her kids to camp.
The judgment of 19 and 20 and 21-year-olds is not perfect. But I've been consulting to camps for over a decade now, and I think the camps that do serious training a week or two or three, I was just at a camp in northern Ontario, and all of the counselors had just gone through wilderness first responder training, which is emergency training in the woods. It was an 8-day course. I mean, it's really intense, with a very demanding exam at the end. And they are better able, these 20-year-olds who took that course would be far better able to help somebody in who was in emergency medical trouble in the wilderness than I could, or most of the older people I know. These are, you know, we do send 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds into combat. We do have officers in the Army who are that young, and although their brains aren't completely finished, Rochelle's experience makes me unhappy to hear of it. But I think that if they are well chosen and well trained, I think young people can make a connection with kids and bring out some of the best in kids in a way that sometimes people in their 40s can't.
Yeah, I remember my older boy, you know, obviously he's the oldest, so he doesn't have an older brother. And just the connections that he's made with those, you know, those 19, 20-year-old, 21-year-old counselors, it just, you know, you just, I almost get choked up watching him with them, the way he looks up to them and so forth.
Such closeness and admiration. And where in our society can 12-year-olds spend a summer getting to know a 20-year-old and have a 20-year-old be genuinely interested in him or her?
Well, Rochelle, I really appreciate the call and you raising your concerns. And let's go next to Maggie in Wolfboro. Hi, Maggie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. I went to Camp Onaway in Hebron, New Hampshire for 2 years, and it was a tremendous experience. First of all, I grew up with older brothers, so it was a really different experience for me to spend 8 weeks at a girls' camp. And two things really stood out in my memory 40 years later. I got life skills from Red Cross swimming and Red Cross canoeing training. And I also saw girls in leadership positions mentoring me. And I did not experience that in school. And I saw these were girls who were going to good schools and who were, you know, it made me think about things in a different way. And I am just a huge proponent.
So just 2 years, how come not more, Maggie?
I then took summer jobs and, you know, it was, I guess I was probably 12 and 13, and then it was time to, you know, do something different.
Sort of aged out, yeah. Thank you for calling in. Do you want to jump in on that, Michael? And I have another question for you.
I think Maggie said it all for me.
Well, I guess one question that comes up in my mind, I don't know if you addressed this in the book or not. I didn't see it. The idea of single-sex sleepaway camps, you know, all boys. Maggie went to an all-girls. Camp Belknap that you mentioned earlier is an all-boy camp.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Girls' camp right next door.
Yes, indeed. And I'm sure there are plenty of raids back and forth. But but do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, look, people ask me, because I'm the psychologist for an all-boys independent school, they say, well, you must believe in single-sex education. And I tell them, I hope if you send your child to a single-sex school, you'll send them to a co-ed summer camp.
I see.
If your child goes to a co-ed school, I hope you'll send them to a single-sex summer camp for just the reasons Maggie described. She got to see girls in leadership positions that she didn't see in school. And there is nothing more inspiring for an 11-year-old girl than to see an 18-year-old girl in charge of a cabin. And that littler girl looks up and thinks, I want to be that. That's the road to adulthood and responsibility. I want to be like that.
You know, earlier before the show, Cole sent us a tweet. He said, we're not sending our kids to sleepaway camp, but it's more due to cost than parenting style. And Cole, thanks for that. We talked about this earlier, Michael, but I would like to hit on it again. Lots of kids don't go to camp because they just can't afford it.
Right. And there are organizations which create camps for people who can't pay the fancy fees at fancy camps. I wrote a chapter about a camp in Vermont that's in a state park, Downer State Forest, and the camp wonderfully has the name Camp Downer.
Camp Downer. That's
Camp
a great
Downer
marketing name.
Yes. When you're wearing your Camp Downer T-shirt, that confuses people. The five women, all in their early 30s, all mothers, whom I talked to about the friendships that they built over many summers, going just one week, and seeing each other, and how special those relationships were. And then they bonded more deeply when they all became counselors at Camp Downer. But Camp Downer is still the cheapest camp in Vermont, and there are inexpensive camps. And I don't believe that having a fancy photography course or a fancy woodshop makes a camp. I mean, my son teaches woodshop at a camp right now, and I think it's a great experience. But you don't have to have a lot of equipment to make a camp. You need creativity and spontaneity and nature.
And read the story about the gals at Camp Downer, because it is a great story. Cole, thank you for that tweet. And let's take one more call if we could, Michael. This is Will in Jackson. Go ahead, Will. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for this talk. It's great. I just wanted to point out that the first independent summer camp in the United States was actually founded by a Dartmouth student called Ernest Balch, and he founded this camp called Camp Chikorwa Squam Lake. And the whole idea, he created these principles called the Camp Chikorwa Principles about making the campers more independent and able to work with each other to build their own fires, cook. And that's been going on since the 1880s. And New Hampshire is really the birthplace of summer camp.
Well, on Squam Lake, is that what you said, Will?
That's true. It was called A Squam Lake at that time, but it's on Squam Lake. And there's a plaque to it on Church Island on Squam Lake.
That's great. Will, I did not know that. Thank you very much for calling
in. And I'm really glad Will brought it up. New Hampshire has a very strong claim. Other places dispute it. There's a camp in New York State that disputes it. But I'll go with New Hampshire. Hey, I'm on New Hampshire Public Radio at the moment. And but he's right that the aim of camp was to create children of character and independence. And that was true in 1880. It continues to be true. I think camp's a great American invention.
Michael, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much, and enjoy your summer.
Thank you, Laura.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Michael Thompson. He's a renowned child psychologist, author or co-author of 9 books on children and families, including his newest, Homesick and Happy, How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Conway, and tomorrow on The Exchange, summing up the Supreme Court. A flurry of rulings by the country's highest court last week addressed some major issues: religious freedom and labor rights, digital privacy, and the extent of police and presidential power, all marking the end of a momentous judicial year. We'll examine how these decisions might affect future debates and what they say about the court itself. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from your listeners and from ServiceLink, New Hampshire's aging and disability resource centers, home of SMP, helping seniors prevent Medicare fraud. Answers to your Medicare questions at 1-866-634-9412. And the law firm of Donahue, Tucker & Chandela, offering legal representation to New Hampshire businesses, individuals, and municipalities, with offices in Exeter, Portsmouth, and Meredith.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. Senate is back in session today. The House returns tomorrow. But with Congress so divided, expectations are low that lawmakers will accomplish anything of significance before midterm elections. Immigration reform is